Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Section we're going over here today is Bahar, which covers Leviticus 25 and the first two verses of chapter 26. And we picked up passages in Jeremiah 32 and also Luke chapter 4. And you can see all the various studies we've done on this over the years at hallel.info/p32. So some of the kind of key main points to look at in this passage and the next passage, which the B'chol Kotai, which will cover the last couple of chapters of Leviticus and finish out the book of Leviticus, is in this particular one, we're seeing the celebration related to Shavuot, and it includes really a remembrance of the giving of the Ten Statements or the Ten Commandments at Sinai. And then you also have seen in here that there is the cycle of sevens, and Shavuot, which means sevens, it is a cycle that also includes the Shemitah, which is the sabbatical year, which is a cycle of 7 years, and then seven sevens of those years, so seven Shemitah years. And then you add a year on top of that, and then you get the Yobel, or the Jubilee year. So sevens stacked upon sevens stacked upon sevens. And that is all wrapped up in a very curious sort of interplay between the word that is Shavah, and Shavah is what we get seven from, the Hebrew word seven, but it also means oath. So that is where we get the idea that seven is a symbol of you are saying it will happen, because Shavah is another word for oath. So oath and seven are very similar and almost used interchangeably in Hebrew together. So, but you also have in that of Shabbat, and that is where we get Sabbath from. Now, Shabbat, it just strictly means stop. So that is, we say, well, it is rest, but strictly speaking, it means to just stop, to cease what it is that you're doing. So you say, well, okay, you rest during that part. But it also just means that you are reaching the end of something. So bring whatever you were doing before to an end. So that's when we think of the weekly Shabbat, that whatever we were doing during the 6 days before, that we stop that during the time of Shabbat. So then we pick it up again. And it's very interesting interplay in that with the cycle that we're in right now leading up to Shavuot, these seven sevens plus one of days, that this is really all about bringing in a harvest, because you are counting the sevens, and then you are counting and bringing the offerings of the grain coming in. So one part of grain after another, leading up to the great day or the feast of sevens or the feast of weeks. And as we close out the book of Vayikra, we'll be doing that next week, but this, and we're bringing the book of Vayikra or Leviticus in for a landing here with this reading here today and the one we'll be doing next Shabbat, that with this, it's a reminder that the Lord is passing along more about what is it means to be other, to be apart from the world around you. That is a part of what the lesson of the tabernacle is. It's not only just that there is a way to deal with the sins, transgressions, and iniquities that we all get wrapped up in, but that there is the ways of the kingdom are so much different from the world that is around you. So when we look at the topics that we're looking at in particular in this book of Bahar, one of the things that we see in this particular section is this talking about the Shavit, or the seventh year of the Shemitah, or the seventh year. That is the seventh year of release. So you have got 7 years, and at the end of each cycle of seven, there is a release. But then there's also a release at the end of the seven sevens plus one on the end of that. So you have this idea that you are protecting those who get caught up in this, who get caught up in, they have a debt. They have a debt that they have worked up. They had to sell. They lost their property. Now, when we saw in the reading, we were seeing about how you redeem your land back if you sell it. Well, one should ask the question, why should I even bother about it, getting it back? I mean, it'll just return to me anyway. Why should I bother about getting the land back? I'll just get it back anyway. Now, you could think that, but would that really be a good faith dealing? And we talk about good faith with contracts. What does good faith with contracts mean? Pay your debts. Okay, so if you have an obligation, you say, you're going to cover my expenses or give me some sort of compensation or give me some sort of money, and then I will pay it back to you over time or whatever the terms are on it. So by good faith, you know, I have received something from you, the lender, so then I am going to give back as the borrower what I agreed to on the terms of what we agreed to on this. So that's what you would say, acting in good faith on this. Piran.
I didn't notice it before, but it said that was only applicable to people that had homes inside the city walls, that they had to come back and claim them. Otherwise, it wouldn't return.
Yes,
to
them. That was if it's inside of a walled city, and then so that would be automatic. you have a 1 year basically right to claim it. But for those that are outside, you know, you could just say, well, it's going to return to me anyway. Then why should I be so eager to get it? And that's a very interesting sort of thing, because that would be gaming the system, you could say. But there was already the explanation that we had in this chapter about gaming the system already, right? About counting the number of years and just say, hey, you know, I'm going to sell it at the end of the term, and then because I'm going to get it back anyway. So I was like, no, you got to what we call with their big fancy term of prorate it. You prorate it based upon what? Years. But what are you actually counting? You're not just counting a term on a loan here. You're talking harvests. Because why? Why are you counting harvests? The harvest, that's what you get from it, because what are you as the, quote, owner? You're a steward. You might say this is a land lease, really. This is like a land lease, kind of like in China actually has this concept. Theirs is more, it has historically been on a 99-year cycle, but you never own anything. At best, you get a land lease. And you get to use it for a certain period of time. But then at the end of that, that you don't get to pass it on. It goes back to the government. Yeah, Larry, we got a comment or a question over there. Anyway, the reality of it anyway.
It doesn't belong to us or our heirs.
Yeah, it doesn't belong to us or our heirs. It belongs to the one who gave it. Now, see, that's a very interesting difference. And we'll be getting to a little bit of that further on, you could say, a Bible-based, or you could say originally Bible-interested culture versus one that is not really based upon what the Bible is teaching. Because with the idea of where you have, especially in the United States, it's been about land ownership. Now, there's all sorts of things that have resulted from that since this country is founded that have eroded from the idea that when you purchase a property, it is actually yours. There have been erosions into that idea. You know, for example, if you live in a community development that has an HOA on it, you don't pay your dues, what happens? They can take it. So is it actually yours? No, it isn't. If you live anywhere that has property taxes and you don't pay them, what happens? They can take it. So is it actually yours? No, it isn't. So those are some erosions that have happened in there because of what? Greed, or you could say bad faith dealings. Bad faith dealings have happened because there have been some that just said, I'm not going to be any sort of support for the area around. So they don't pay their property taxes. And if a lot of people decide not to pay your property taxes, you know, on the good side of that, then you don't have the services that that's supposed to pay for. But on the bad side of that is, well, then you don't actually own your property. And it is the government just coming in to try to take it. So that's from the other side of the equation, where you have kind of the Chinese model of it, is that, well, that comes from a more going even back to a Confucian idea that you don't actually have separate parts of things that are of yourselves. It's all a part of somebody else's, whether it's the ruler who owns everything. And you saw that model in Europe with the feudal system, where you as the serf didn't actually own it. You were basically working, you were living at the mercy of the Lord, who would allow you to live on the property. So you didn't actually own the property. The Lord owned everything. And if the Lord wanted it, the Lord just took it. And, or if the Lord demanded more and more and more from you, well, what can you do? You just have to pay more and more and more for it. So you were not really independent. A serf became, because of what? Bad faith, became a slave. A serf really was slavery in a lot of places. There were good lords that were benevolent and really didn't exact things. But the thing is the old adage of absolute power corrupting absolutely is a huge temptation. Because if you have the ability to take the power, that element that comes in there of greed, coveting, etc., that we see in the Ten Commandments, what would a natural inclination be? To take advantage. And you see, that's why you have the warning about bad faith in this. Now, the interesting situation that we just saw in the passage we were looking at here today in Jeremiah chapter 32, where it was talking about this strange land transfer that's going on, that Jeremiah is undertaking this property acquisition, which just seems odd. And you get this picture, well, why in the midst of, you know, your absolute misery that's happening in the land, why is the prophet getting involved in a property transfer? Yes, Christine, we have a comment or a question over there.
Hello. I'm not sure if that was a rhetorical question or if you really wanted us to answer.
Well, go ahead.
Well, it seemed to me that it was just part of the seed of prophecy that has continued, that God chose Israel. God chose the land. And God will, and he chose the people. So it was a hope shot. It was letting those that Jeremiah had prophesied, letting you know, you will go into captivity. You will be taken away, but you will return to this land because God has said so. Mm. And put it in the jars of clay. Is that what?
Yeah, but it is a very interesting picture that you were talking about there with the documents. And even as we have in this description in Jeremiah, you'll see what they talk about in the covenants, and they talk about these various aspects of the transaction, and you see those things today. If you've ever taken a look at a recorded deed on there, you'll see all kinds of various terms that go into it. And if they were talking about, if you are a part of an HOA or some other thing that has some other covenants and other things that you have to agree to, you'll see those things recorded in there as well. So it's a very interesting picture that the prophet is giving. It's like, okay, you people who are so concerned about your property, you'll be more than willing to adhere to all of the terms of these documents that you deal between men and the transfers of property. Did you pay attention to any of the terms of the property that you were given in the land when the Lord took you out from the house of bondage and put you into the land? Did you pay attention to any of those terms of those covenants or documents in that? You like so much the contracts that are done between people, and you got all of your clauses and everything that you're supposed to adhere to between the parties, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, you'll be so interested about those terms, but are you interested in the terms under which you're living here in the land? Now, if you might recall, what were some of the key reasons that were given in the prophets for why the exiles happened, why Israel was given a big time out of the land? Didn't let the land rest. Interesting. Okay, so because the land didn't get its Shemitah, guess what, Israel? You're going to get a Shemitah as well. The land is going to have it, and it's not just 7 years. It's not just 50 years. It's going to be 7 times 10 years, and it's going to be 70 years of rest. And for some of the nations, like the northern tribes, much, much, much longer. It goes on and on and on because they never fully returned. There was never a full return of them. So for that, it just goes on and on for that rest that the land is having. But, you know, the other things about giving your children into the fires of Molech. So you got the idea of letting the land rest, which means what? You are, like we were talking about earlier with the crops, you're counting crops, meaning pay attention to who the giver of crops is. It's not because of how fantastic you are that you're getting all these crops. So pay attention when you see those crops go by and go into your storehouses, and you do commerce based on these crops that are coming in. Where are these crops coming from? Well, it's the one who is providing the bounty that's making this happen. And what about the children? Are the children just yours that you can just pass them into the fire to some deity? Now, why is it that people would give their children over to Molech? What would Molech give them? Crops. Oh, that was that idea that they were trying to get crops from the various fertility deities, whether it be Molech or Asherah or whoever it was. They were going to get crops, bounty, favor. So they weren't going to let the land rest to recognize where their favor for their sustenance came from. And then they were going to give their children over, and children are a gift of the Lord. So they were going to give their children over to some deity to get favor back in the land. And the Lord said, for these couple of reasons, you're going to get a timeout here. Yes, Christine, go ahead.
Well, I think about my own life before this walk, how I gave my child to Molech to chase my idols of power and influence, and how maybe my latchkey child or go to daycare a little early child. So, you know, it's always not just about the ancients, it's about looking at our lives today and applying and looking at who may be our idols and have I given my child, did I give my child to Molech and pass through the fire, so to speak, right? So it's sobering for us today and my daughter and her children and future generations as well, that we can learn about passing our children through the fire.
Yes, indeed. So these lessons are ones that, as Christy mentioned, we should be learning on a regular basis, that these aren't things from just long ago that have no application to our life today, but you are taking these lessons and moving them forward. So when Jeremiah is doing this transaction here about a title to property, what were the people then not doing? They wanted to not let the land rest, meaning what? They were not wanting to let their slaves free, which is also another part of the Shemitah and the Yobel. They're like, everybody, this land is mine. These people are mine. Are they actually yours? No. No, not that whatsoever. So, because you're not willing to open your hand to let the bounty that the Lord gives you free, then what is the Lord going to do? Pry your fingers open and take it out of your hand. Until what? You recognize where the bounty actually came from. And return. Yes, return, repent, come back. And so thus, you see, you have a return, but it wasn't as bountiful as those that were taken away. So many went off, not that many actually returned. Yes, Larry, go ahead, please.
I'm wondering, is there any way for a slave from a foreign people to get freed under that system?
Now, one of the things that we saw in this was that the sojourner and such living among you. What
got though and brought back?
What changes a person's status that you see? Remember Naomi? This assimilation. They say, I am no longer a foreigner. Your God is my God. Your people are my people. So you are no longer a stranger anymore, which is one of the key things of what's behind the Abrahamic promise. The Abrahamic promise is that everybody is going to be a part of the people of God. They're all going to be a part of Abraham's family over time. You're not going to have just the little clique of descendants of Abraham and then all the other people around there that are just going to be, you know, looking in from the outside. It's that, no, this is going to be a house of prayer for all people, not to just come through like a museum and go, oh, well, that's cool, then go back to whatever you're doing before, but to be a magnet to say, hey, your God is my God. Your people are my people. I want to join this. I want to be a part of this. Yes, go ahead.
Mark Berry, good to see you all.
Good to see you.
Visiting. So allegiance with Israel is one thing. Becoming a Hebrew is something else. Hebrew is to have passed over. Mm. So the slaves that would align themselves with Israel, if they went the next step, would then become Hebrew or Hebraic. Because they will have passed over, they would have made a change of kingdoms from the kingdom of this world system into the kingdom of Yehovah.
Yep, indeed. Which is what the main issue that you could see that Paul was having when he was having the interchanges, and you see that also with the Acts chapter 15 interchange. What kind of hurdle are you going to make for those people coming in? Because the argument was making, hey, the hurdle for Abraham was low. Who are you to move that bar higher? If God kept it low, why are you moving the bar higher for people to make that move, the change over. Yes.
Real quick, I just wanted to confess, sort of like my sister here did, Christine. Similarly, when I first met God in 1998 in a bathroom, and I was saved by Yeshua on accident and was filled with the Holy Spirit. Yeah, I know. I just didn't try to do it. It just happened is what I mean. Thank you. Yes, no accidents. Yes. I created a breach between me and God by, disavowing a contract by going out and drinking with the old clique, the old kingdom, so to speak. After that, I no longer felt filled with the Holy Spirit, and I felt this massive separation from God. And then I began to turn to false entities to try to fulfill what I had lost with Him. And it got darker and darker, and I didn't have the knowledge to know what was happening exactly. And it took, I'm 45 now, and it's taken all these years to put the pieces of the puzzle back together and to come back to Him and have His fulfillment and His presence in my life. And it has just been a long, drawn out, horrible journey. But I feel like the bad stuff is kind of going in the past now, and I'm kind of getting back, So I just felt like I wanted to say that to the congregation here. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things. We got a number of examples throughout the people of God of how that path can happen. I mean, the king, prince, Shaul, Saul, his journey was like that. It didn't have to end how it did. There was lots of lifelines that God kept throwing out there. And one of the key ones was David, who kept visiting him and saying, hey, I could take your life at any time. I'm not going to, because why? The Lord has anointed you, and I am not going to just step in and just take action here at any point in time. But every encounter with David, it's like, turn around, Shaul, turn around, turn around, turn around. And you see, you fast forward a bit when you come up into the apostolic era and you see Paul's encounter there in Corinth and his letters, like the first letter. And they had people in that congregation. It's like, the guy's behavior was reprehensible. They just had to say, look, you've got to leave. But the point was to wake him up. Because you see in a follow-up letter, 2 Corinthians, that God got through to him. And he did wake up. And he came back in and was accepted back in. So that is how Shaul's story could have ended. It could have ended much differently than it did. But the idea is that when God stops talking to you, what do you do? Do you start going to mediums, to sorcerers and whatever, trying to, quote, hack the kingdom of God by some other way, pole vaulting over the wall or whatever? Yeah, Saul tried it and it didn't work. Tried to find some other way in. Tried to go find that tree of knowledge of good and bad and eat from it. And nope. Could never quite get a satisfying or full meal from it. Yes, Larry, go ahead, please.
Well, it's one of the things that we get from the world is they say the Bible espouses slavery, or what's the word that allows slavery? And we're saying, well, no, it's indentured servitude. But those ones that they went out and got, brought back, and made into slaves, they said they could bequeath them to their children. Yes. But the problem is, I guess the difference that I can see from what you're saying is that the slaves that were brought over here from Africa to the United States, they became Americans. They became they worshiped the same God. They became part of the family, but they were not allowed to be free.
Yes, and that was where you would have in our South. They had their Saul moment where they had the influence on those who came into who they bought at markets and this and that. And they had, for those that they taught the ways of God, they taught who the true God was, and that got passed down to the, their slaves, at that point, they could have taken the further lesson of Israel and said, hey, now we don't take advantage of them anymore. And you do see that some decided to say, okay, no, it's, we got to walk away from this. We've got to walk away from this particular path that we're going. Do you have a comment before we go on any further? Or?
I do. It's kind of a response to my brother here. I'll try to tie it into everything that's going on. One of my great mentors and teachers was Art Katz, Messianic Jew. Used to argue with the founders of Jews for Jesus because he had a fixation on truth and amazing man of God. He wrote a book about Paul's conversion called, it was about apostolic conversion. And in it, he says, many saved, few converted. There's a difference between being saved and converted, which brings me to my brother's testimony here. Scripture says they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of the testimony, but you don't hear the other end. And they loved not their lives even unto death. I just heard a testimony this morning of a brother who's been an amazing man of God. He's literally dying now. He's probably got a month or two left, full of joy. His chariot's coming. He's okay with the fact that his chariot was cancer. He said, when I go, let my chariot be cancer. It'll give me time. So he's seeing his life wrapped up. We're spending the weekend with him, all these beautiful things. But at 3 months into the Lord, he was working in a mental hospital and demons jumped on him from one of the patients. He knew the Lord. He was freed, but a demon jumped on him from one of the patients, nearly ruined his life. The thing that got him free was he loved the word of the Lord, the blood of the Lamb, the word of his testimony, the blood of the Lamb, and he loved his life not unto death. When he laid down and said, until I am free of my life, I want connection with God. I want to be in the kingdom. I don't want to have anything to do with this world. That's what freed him. Blood of the Lamb, word of the testimony, and loving not your life even unto death. That's the cross. The cross of Messiah is the PowerPoint that sets us free. Everything of this world has got to go to the cross.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. So we were talking earlier about, you know, what is it that when you were talking about those servants, slaves from the nations brought in, and we have the example of Americans' history of it could have been different. They could have taken the exit ramp. It didn't have to go as badly as it did. And you can see that even at the beginning of this country, people had the idea. I mean, if you've ever gone to Philadelphia and gone to see the Independence Hall there, where they have the Liberty Bell on it, you know, the Liberty Bell that was on there has the inscription there from Leviticus 25:10. In fact, it's written right on the bell. There's in Leviticus, it's in Roman numerals, but Leviticus 25:10, you know, proclaimed liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. And one of the key aspects was this, that was used from this bell, because this bell was actually put up in the 1750s into the Pennsylvania State House. It was the State House bell before that. But then you could see in the earlier part of the 1800s where it was then taken to mean something else. And where the first time you got a record of it being used to call the Liberty Bell was by the Anti-Slavery Record in 1835, where they referenced that text that's on that bell and said, hey, this is what the mission of this country is, to proclaim liberty to the captives, to set them free, to realize, okay, you know, there may have been a service at some particular point in time, but, you know, we are supposedly led by the Lord here. So if the Lord says, let captives free, then we should as well. And that lesson and was not taken, just like with Yehuda, Jehuda, and the northern tribes did not let their captives free. South and even parts of the North with some of the sentiment when in there didn't see that as something to keep within their knowledge either. And all kinds of misery resulted from it. Yes, Larry.
And the paradox of that bell is cracked and it doesn't sound right when it's rung anymore. They haven't tried to ring it now for about 100 years.
Yeah.
It cracked around the Civil War.
Yeah, because it was ringing for, I think, somewhere between 80 to 90 years before they noticed that the crack was forming in it. So that is one particular aspect that we should... yes, Anne, do you have a comment or a question?
I'm wondering where and when does the slave get the chance to say to his master, I want to be yours forever, and get the all put in his ear. Is this a different time, or we're talking about the year of Yubel and other things now?
Well, if there's the kind of like the indentured servant, and he would be available to take use of the Shemitah and go free, or the Yubel and go free. But he said, I don't want to go free. So he then could say, I want to serve this household forever. Now, one should take the message from that to say, hey, look, if you've got someone in here from among your brothers in Israel, and you can offer this option of going free, what are you then doing about those who you drug in from the nations, whether it be by war or whatever, wherever you got them from the outside? Are you treating them just as less than employees? Or are you saying, hey, they should be someone who should know the Lord? You know, you think of how Naaman, how did he know about Elisha, slave girl. Now, that was the opposite. He was a commander of a force, foreign force that had come in and was a subjugator of Israel. But the girl that he took away, well, don't know exactly what her lineage was or how long or whether she came in as a family or whatnot, but she ended up in this household. But what was her heart mission on this? To share, to lead. So when you see this example, that whether you're talking about Yosef in the household of Pharaoh, or in the household of Potiphar before that, or in the prison, or if you're talking about Daniel under a couple of different empires and serving different people, their mission in all of that was to do what? To direct people to the true source of help. And in the process, you see with Mitzrayim, Egypt is transformed under the particular pharaohs that knew Yosef, the land prospered. Later on, the one who and his lineage who did not know Yosef, they were crushed. Egypt was crushed and their economy was brought to its knees by the deity of their slave population. So, you're thinking of the lineage coming forward. And again, this is the message that comes in with the Yubel. Like you were delivered out of Mitzrayim, so when the Shemitah comes around, when the Yubel comes around, what should you be thinking about? Because I was freed, so I will do what? I will free others, whether it be debts, whether it be actual contracts or slavery, whether you're talking about property. Yeah, I will get my grubby little paws off of it, and it will go back to where it was owned before. So with that particular lesson, you know, we see a aspect of this story with Yeshua, forgive us our debts. And we saw in the particular aspect with the quotation that we saw where he was in the synagogue and he was quoting from Isaiah chapter 61. And we had read that earlier on in our service today, Isaiah 61, 1 through 3. And there is the stop where he stopped in the midst of that prophecy they're about proclaiming. And he doesn't go on because it goes on and it's more like a conquering messianic figure type of it. So thus you'll see some of the synagogue will say, well, you can't be the Mashiach because the Mashiach is supposed to do the whole thing down to verse 3 and on and going. Well, the thing though is that it is a day of the Lord dichotomy. There is the aspects of the servant of the Lord that are aspects of suffering, and then there are aspects of the servant of the Lord that are conquering. You see those in Isaiah. Servant of the Lord who suffers, servant of the Lord who conquers. And Isaiah 61 has both of them mixed in together. You see the one in the beginning part of Isaiah 61, which Yeshua quoted when he was in the synagogue. Yeshua quoted this, that he was going to do what? To heal. To open the eyes of the blind. And to deal with all of these particular aspects on that. What were these particular aspects related to? Suffering. These are suffering of people. But you see in one of the great servant of the Lord passages in Isaiah 52, 53, how does that servant of the Lord, the suffering one, deal with these particular ailments? He takes them on. He takes them on. He is afflicted by them. He is wounded by them. He's crushed by them by taking on all of these particular ailments, whether they are the blindness of the people, taking on all their sicknesses. That's why is this particular suffering Messiah is called the leper Messiah, because taking on even the tzaraat that we had seen earlier when we were going through the leprosy passages in Leviticus, taking on all of these ailments to the point of being a pariah. But the amazing part is that the pariah Messiah is really the most treasured and precious part of Israel, because that pariah Messiah, one that you don't want in your midst, is the one who takes on all of the things that you want to get rid of. Should be reminding you of something that we celebrate every year, a memorial of Yom Kippur, that there is all the things that you don't want in your congregation. You heap them on the scapegoat or the goat for Azazel, and it is gone. You take that away, and it is remembered no more, which is also an aspect of what? It's the new covenant prophecy, again in Jeremiah 31, that he takes away the iniquities and remembers them no more. Hallelujah. So praise be for that. So when Yeshua was teaching his students how to pray for heaven's mercy, and it calls really for a training by the Spirit in really living a merciful life. So when he goes on in this part recorded here in Matthew chapter 6, verses 11 through 13, give us this day our daily bread and forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors, and do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from evil. So what do you say in that? What do you see in that as far as the proportion of mercy? Greater mercy. So you're saying, forgive us our debts as we have also forgiven our debtors. So that should be telling you about when you're looking at the Shemitah, the Yobel, these idea of discharge and release. Why are you doing that? Because you have been forgiven. You have had those things that were against you discharged. You've been released out of your house of bondage. So thus, you do what to other people? Release them out of their houses of bondage, the things that you might have a bondage on somebody else, whether it's something they did to you, so they have a debt in your side. What then should you do? Discharge it. Get rid of it. So moving on further, this is really a key qualifier that we saw in a previous Torah passage when we were looking at back in Leviticus chapter 19 with the golden rule as it's recorded in Leviticus 19:18. But a key portion of that is verse 17, which leads up to it. And one of the things that you see is there, do not seek vengeance and do not hold a grudge against your brother. But what? You will love your neighbor as yourself. So really, seek good outcomes. You know, you should not be looking for holding something against somebody else to carry that debt that they owe you because of the injury that they have done to you. Yes, ouch indeed. So also, if you roll back the tape, is that you don't just let them go off and flounder in that, but rather reprove them. But don't hold it out as like a holier than thou, because are we really holier? Only because of the one who does what? Makes us holy. Are we any separate from anything else? Yes, we have a comment or a question over here.
Again, my mentor, Art Katz, was fond of calling Christians on the carpet for being make nice Christians, not calling each other to account and helping each other hold righteousness and holiness as a standard in their lives and in the lives of others. And I would add that because of that, we have the nation we have. He would say in a fantastic message on the cross, and they crucified him, absolutely foundational, famous for most people that study these things. You can probably put the Christian church at task for most of the problems in America today because they've been making nice instead of holding standards. And it was one of the God is dead atheists, was it Nietzsche, who said, if the church will not be radically holy, the world will become radically depraved.
Yeah, it is an interesting observation that you would see in that idea is that, well, if you don't have a standard bearer, what do you need to have? The Ubermensch. And you don't want the Ubermensch or the Superman. You don't want that. Because if you do not have that sort of governor within yourself, because one of the things we talk about in the founding part of our country is something that John Adams said when he wrote about the U.S. Constitution and why it is about encapsulating liberty and really in keeping it enshrined as liberty being a really key part of it, is that we have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Our Constitution was made only for a mortal and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Because what happens if you do not respect a law of liberty? Defenses have to get higher and higher and higher. Because why? People continually want to jump over it. If they don't respect the fences, what will they do? They'll find ways to dig underneath it, pole vault over it, cut the fence down, come up with ways around it, try to sneak through the fence. If you do not kind of keep and respect boundaries, then what happens to the boundaries? They have to get thicker, taller, more egregious, more onerous. They have to keep being more restrictive because why? You have issues where some people do not act in good faith. So those who act in bad faith then call down all kinds of restrictions upon all sorts of other people. Yeah, there's that old maxim about, what is it, the 80% of laws are made for the 20% of people or something like that, is that for those people who are self-regulated, then you don't need really many restrictions. If you have people with their maxim, you know, the Shema and the Golden Rule, and they live by that, and they live all their lives by that, so that their word is their bond. And if you enter an agreement with them, you can count on it. You know, you don't have to have all kinds of documents with various clauses and such that try to button up all the loopholes that someone can think of to get around it. No, you're both acting in good faith. And so your agreements can be a handshake. But if you don't act in good faith, what? The documents have to get longer and longer and longer and longer and longer and longer. And then you have to get lawyers that start looking at this and, well, maybe you can do this and maybe you can get around that. Well, you see a little bit in our Torah portion today about the pro rata. And we talked about that earlier, prorating the number of years, whether it be fewer or lesser. And then you work out your compensation in that. Why do you have that in there? You're saying this is a heart issue. You're not robbing your neighbor. You're not robbing your neighbor. So take it into mind that if there are fewer years, there should be a different value than if there are longer years to the Yobel or the Shemitah. So if there are longer or shorter years, you compensate people differently. I mean, if people don't get that idea, you can lay that out there simply. But if they don't even get that idea, and their heart still keeps looking for ways around it, what then do you start having to do? We go through it every April here in this country. But the tax law, and the tax law gets longer and longer and longer and longer and longer and longer. Because why? People keep trying to find this way and that way and this way and that way around it. And the restrictions get longer and longer. So, when you talk about the change of having a new heart and a new spirit put within you, that is so that when we get down to finally in Deuteronomy chapter 30, where you start seeing the circumcision of the heart, that part of us that is always looking for the loophole, that part of us gets cut off and removed, and we leave that behind. And we get transformed into people who truly have a law of liberty. Because we are what? Looking for the good in other people. And if we do wrong other people, then we do what? We turn around and go in a different way. So when we get back to what we were talking about here before with looking for the good of others and how that really applies to the Golden Rule, and that's what's called the Lord's Prayer, you know, that you forgive others as we, or forgive us as we have forgiven others. And Yeshua talked about that. Another says that the measure you use, it will be what? Used against you as well. Do not judge lest you be judged, because that's where the context of that comes in. So if you want to judge other people, make sure that it is with an equal measure, that you're using the same standards on yourself that you might be looking to other people to deal with. Because otherwise, you might realize, just like his other parable with the log and the splinter in your eye, that you might be looking for the splinter in somebody else's eye when you have a log in your own eye. You don't see what you should be seeing. So as we move on further, And we just, in our passage that we were looking at with the golden rule, we were looking at Matthew 18. And that is really a good parallel passage to Leviticus 19 with the golden rule in it. And we see kind of in a parallel to that, at the end of Matthew chapter 18, there's the passage that starts in verse 21 and goes through verse 35, of where the Apostle Peter is asking Yeshua if forgiving seven times qualified as perfect mercy, because what? Remember, seven, Shiva, oath, make it so, you can count on it. So if you forgive seven times, wow, you've done a wonderful thing. You perfect, perfect forgiveness. But Yeshua says, no, not just seven times, 70 times seven, at least 490 times. And yeah, if you're keeping count up to 489, it's time to start looking at what's going on with inside of you, if you're keeping tally to that exactness. But let's take a look and see this particular parable, picking it up here in verse 23 of Matthew 18. For this reason, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his slaves. And when he had begun to settle them, one who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. But since he did not have the means to repay, his Lord commanded him to be sold, along with his wife and children and all that he had, and repayment to be made. So the slave fell to the ground and prostrated himself before him, saying, "Have patience with me, and I will repay you everything." And the Lord of that slave felt compassion and released him and forgave him the debt. But that slave went out and found one of his fellow slaves who owed him 100 denarii. And he seized him and began to choke him, saying, "Pay back what you owe." So this fellow slave fell to the ground and began to plead with him, saying, "Have patience with me, and I will repay you." But he was unwilling and went and threw him in prison until he should pay back what he owed. So when his fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were deeply grieved and came and reported to their lord all that had happened. Then summoning him, his lord said to him, "You wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not also have had mercy on your fellow slave in the same way that I had mercy on you?" And his Lord, moved with anger, handed him over to the torturers until he should repay all that was owed him. My heavenly Father will also do the same to you if each of you does not forgive his brother from your heart. Now remember, this is in the context of what we read at the beginning part of Matthew 18 about that whole thing. You know, if your brother sins against you, you know, you go and you show him his fault. That's what we see there in Leviticus 19:17. If someone is going astray, you should go and reprove him. Why? Because you're trying to turn the screws to him? No. You're saying, "Hey, come back from the cliff. And because, hey, I've been at the cliff too. And the Lord saved me. So I'm trying to say, hey, you can come back from this cliff too. Turn around. Go back." So, thus you see that in that reconciliation process that is described in Matthew 18, where you take in the steps of try to do it one-on-one, try to work it out. If that doesn't work, you try to bring someone else. What? So you can kind of, they hold him and you hit him? No. It's so that you say, "Oh, okay, well, maybe I'm totally off base here. Let's get a second witness here on this." And maybe if that doesn't work, and it's like, then bring it to a congregation, not so that you can publish a gossip rag, but no, so that you can say, well, maybe the first two people were off base, and see what the whole rest of the congregation is. Because it's right before Peter asks a question, Yeshua says, "Hey, every matter between two or three, there I'm in the midst." So it's like, hey, if you're going to come in together and decide something, make sure, number one, that you are using equal balances, that you are seeing the matter clearly, and also realize who it is that you should be bringing into your discussions about this, and that's the Lord, and all of his testimonies of who his character is. That should be informing how you're making this decision here, not just kind of going off on whatever you feel at the moment and how they wronged you and how you're going to get even. No, that's not how you should be treating this situation whatsoever. I'm sorry, Larry, you got your hand up there. Do you have a comment or a question or something?
Your preamble, when you read the thing from Ezekiel about
Ezekiel, yeah,
when the evil man turns from his evilness.
Yes,
but the next right in the next verse, it says the opposite, that if you don't, if the righteous person turns from his righteousness, his righteousness will no longer be remembered.
Forever. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So you can definitely turn around, but if you turn around then from going the right direction and go off to somewhere else, it negates the whole thing. So yeah, thank you. Yes, if you insist on jumping off the cliff and going off into the realm of Sheol and his route, look to see where that road ended, and it wasn't pretty. It's not the fall, it's the stop. It's a sudden stop. Yes, the change in kinetic energy is pretty bad. Yes, don't want all that transferred back into your body. So one of the things we should be seeing here with these parables that Yeshua is telling, and various ones about the merciful and unmerciful servants, it really should be showing us about what a new heart-led approach is to the Torah, and how it should be teaching us about how we deal with all kinds of myriad social justice things that happen in our society. Because there are definite ills that are in our society, whether you talk about predatory lending, whether talking about employee exploitation and discrimination, and goes on and on and on and on. And there is truth to that. Those things do happen, and that is bad faith that goes into why those things happen. People are exploiting their power and such. Well, what is the solution? One of the things that's being presented in many corners of our society today is that what? You just get your own lever of power and then cram it down on those to take the power away from them. But the problem is that we see what happens with that kind of an approach. What happens with that kind of approach is what? Again, the power thing again. Power corrupts, and people who will try to use power for good purposes, the problem is that it goes awry very fast. And we see that in modern history, whether talking about ancient history, modern history, the French Revolution was a very good example of such a thing. Started out with great intentions because of all kinds of terrible things that the French monarchy was doing. Horrific things that were going on. Complete disdain and lack of regard for what the common people were facing with, you know, lack of food and this and that and the other. Well, what started out with a great idea, but then just turning the tables of power around from the French aristocracy to the proletariat, so to speak, the common people, is what? A reign of terror. Yes, you definitely had the clerical authorities that were in there turned against them as well. And for the things that were gross abuses of power of what the clerical authorities were doing, what was then the result of that? A turn against the worship of God in and of itself, and actually trying to basically ban God. I mean, they even threw out the 7-day week, tried to bring in a 10-day week, and then had a big kind of rattle around, was it 2-week period at the end of the year, where they tried to reconcile a 10-day week with a solar year, and it doesn't work well. But so threw off all kinds of things, threw them into horrific terror. And what was the solution to all that? Napoleon. It'd bring in Napoleon to fix that. So great, you had a terrible thing at the beginning part. You're going to fix it with the Reign of Terror, and then you have to fix the Reign of Terror with Napoleon, who then brought down France into a disaster when everybody started turning on Napoleon. So, great. So when you try to work and deal with an imbalance of power, an abuse of power, with more power, and just try the, quote, opposite of it, is it really opposite? No, it's just a different shade of the same heart sickness that you're dealing with at the beginning part of it. So thus, the better solution is the forgiving your debts aspect of it. You could say the heavenly economy of discharging debts, memorialized in the Shemitah cycles of 7 years and the Yobel cycles of 49 and 50 years. So that is a memorial of the better way to approach it. It's painful because of that whole trust issue. We read about it in there. Because they even asked that rhetorical question in there. What are we going to eat on the Shemitah year? And then what are we going to eat when we wait for the next cycle of crops to come back in? What are we going to eat? What is the answer to that? Yes, and manna also. You're going to get 3 years in 1 year. And then manna, what is that lesson too? What are we going to eat on that seventh day? God will provide. He provides the double portion on the sixth day to last you through until it starts back up again. This lesson is about trust, otherwise known as faith. Yes, emunah. Are we going to trust? So that is a hugely important aspect to this. So you may have some folk that you see in the South. A lot of people were doing Bible bashing with trying to prove the system of subjugating people was Bible-based. Well, the point is that you miss what was woven in there in between it to why you see not only they learned through the exiles, hey, we don't exploit people, so what do you see at the other end of the exiles? Learn the lesson of idolatry to a certain degree. Learn the lesson of slavery and subjugation to a great degree. You don't see a lot of that showing up. Like when we get to the first century, you see that coming on the Roman side of the equation, because the slavery is a huge part of Roman and every other ancient economy at the time period. But you don't see that sort of thing recurring a lot into the first century. So there was a lot of lessons that were learned in that big time out that happened with the exiles. But some other lessons that had to be learned in there about also the key lesson of forgiving debts between people, and that debts are not always about money or value. It can be about your interpersonal relations. Yeah, yes, Larry.
The thing about slavery and Apostle Paul, when he said, if you are a slave, remain a slave, but then if you're a master, treat your slave as your brother. I mean, how long is that going to mean that you're going to have a slave if you treat him like your brother?
Yeah, that's where that little, tiny little letter of Philemon is really a great lesson in how you have the biblical economy will blow up your systems of subjugation and domination if you follow it with good faith. If you follow it with bad faith, it becomes oppressive just like anything else. But then you, as a called out, special, holy nation, become what? Common, just like everything else. And then either dissipate or be hauled off and put into time out. And the reason why to be hauled off and put into time out was about discipline, because Israel is what? It is a vehicle for something hugely important, and we've been talking about this ever since we've started this Torah cycle about this seed, the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. And the way that you solve it and you get back to the tree of life is seed of the woman is going to come and crush the head of the serpent that started this whole thing going down with the fascination with the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. So that seed going down there and that seed, the promise to Abraham, this is not going to be a social club where you got the secret handshake. This is going to be something where you're going to call all the nations in, that this seed is going to be for all of them, for all nations to become a part of this. So Israel, are you going to live up to the promise of Abraham, or are you going to try to wall it off to be, hey, don't touch my toys? No, this is a message. This is going to be a house of prayer, a call in to all the nations to come in. Because just like you see with the parable of the Good Samaritan, you see the call in is that if God calls out to all nations, even those, quote, half-breeds of Samaria, the leftovers of the exiles who were interbreeding with the peoples that were kind of imported in to dilute and dissipate and wipe out Israel as a culture during the exiles and the Babylonian and Assyrian dominations of it, they still held on to some aspect of it. So that when Yeshua went up to Samaria, he had a willing group of people that were saying, hey, we have an expectation. Yes, the Samarian Pentateuch is slightly different, but there is also that kernel in there, that expectation that was going to come. But was it just for the click elsewhere, or was it saying, hey, you in Samaria, if you realize where the magnet of everything is, yes, the people in charge may have been turning this into something bad, but the one who started, the one who commissioned them, their boss, he loves you too in Samaria. And he wants you also to come in and see the light that's available. And they're just not in Samaria, but also those in the Roman Empire, the ones that are feel and hear the call of God's kingdom. And they say, I want to know who you are. Ones like Cornelius and others, they hear that call and they come in because they know where. Just like you see it foretold in the prophets that they will grab on to the tzitzitot and say, we've heard that God is with you. Why? Because all of the other options around them are crumbling. That's a vision of the day of the Lord. And all of the so-called structures of stability around are falling apart. And they see, hey, there is the rock of stability. And that rock of stability can be in one that you don't even expect. Be in a Yosef, be in a Daniel, people that you don't think are rocks of stability. But Yosef endured from under a subjugation, going from one house to the other through prison, being called out. Daniel survived between administrations, first to Babylon, then to Media, then to Persia. And then being a trusted advisor. That didn't often happen in the ancient world, especially between different empires when you came in. What do you read about that they normally did? Yeah, they normally killed everybody. Why? Because those people are loyal to the regime that came before. So where are you going to have a lot of your insurrection or sabotage issues or et cetera? You're going to have it from the holdovers that you have coming in before. So, yeah, you always have to worry about those particular issues. So that when you finally come down here, that's the ultimate memorial of forgiveness, Yom Kippur. We shouldn't really, you know, we shouldn't seek heaven's mercy if we're unmerciful. That's one of the lessons. And a key part of this, and we bring this up usually on Yom Kippur, it's one of our readings, is Isaiah 58, verses 1 through 12. We start with verse 13 every Shabbat, but in the previous 12 verses of it, it says, "Cry loudly and do not hold back. Raise your voice like a trumpet and declare to my people their transgression and to the house of Jacob their sins. Yet they seek me day by day and delight to know my ways. As a nation that has done righteousness and has not forsaken the ordinance of their God, they ask me for just decisions. They delight in the nearness of God. Why have we fasted and you do not see? Why have we humbled ourselves and you do not notice? Behold, on the day of your fast, you find your desire and drive hard all your workers. Behold, you fast for contention and strife and to strike with a wicked fist. You do not fast like you do today to make your voice heard on high. Is it a fast like this which I chose, which I choose, a day for a man to humble himself? Is it for bowing one's head like a reed and for spreading out sackcloth and ashes on a bed? Will you call this a fast, even an acceptable day to the Lord? Is not the fast which I choose to loosen the bonds of wickedness, to undo the bands of the yoke, and to let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke? Is it not to divide your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into the house, when you see the naked to cover him and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? Then your light will break out like the dawn, and your recovery will speedily spring forth, and your righteousness will go before you. The glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Then you will call, and the Lord will answer. You will cry, and he will say, 'Here I am.' If you remove the yoke from your midst, the pointing of the finger and the speaking wickedness, and if you give yourself to the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then your light will rise in darkness and your gloom will become like midday. And the Lord will continually guide you and satisfy your desire in scorched places and give strength to your bones. And you will be like a watered garden and like a spring of water whose waters do not fail. Those from among you will rebuild the ancient ruins, and you will raise up the age-old foundations, and you will be called to the repairer of the breach, the restorer of the streets in which to dwell." Amen. So what? You rebuild everything, and then restoration comes? No. You restore, and then the rebuilding comes. So, because if you build up the edifice and there's nothing inside, Yeshua had a parable about that. You make the place nice and clean, it doesn't, quote, have the ill things that were happening before, but you haven't dealt with what the issues were that led to the mess to begin with. What then will happen? Seven times worse. That's number seven keeps coming up. So, yes. So thus, when you see that Yom Kippur is a memorial of freedom, and not just a freedom that the sins, transgressions, iniquities are removed and heaven remembers them no more. But if heaven does that, then we should also do that.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.